On 9th of August, 833 CE, Al-Ma'mun died. Usually, with someone like him, a powerful and stable ruler, he would expect his son to succeed him. His son was indeed a great military commander. He had the competency, but he didn't succeed Al-Ma'mun. Al-Ma'mun was instead succeeded by his brother, who came to be known as Al-Mu'tasim. And there was one reason behind this: the Turkic mercenaries. During Al-Ma'mun's reign, Al-Mu'tasim had been in control of a private army of Turkic nomads from the Eurasian steppes. Al-Ma'mun had used them in various military campaigns. One of the biggest advantages that the mercenaries had was that they were loyal to gold, so they could help tip the balance of power in the empire in the caliph's favor. The caliph didn't have to rely on his vassals anymore. It was because of this force that Al-Mu'tasim took control of the empire after his brother's death. This probably looked like a good idea at the time. A similar thing has been tried throughout history, and it has worked exactly zero times, because those mercenaries usually come to the realization that the emperor needs the mercenaries more than the mercenaries need the emperor. The Turks started taking over the establishment. This broke up into many conflicts with the older Abbasid bureaucracy, and Al-Mu'tasim even founded a new city, Samarra, and took his Turkic establishment there. Turkic influence kept growing even after Al-Mu'tasim's death in 842 CE. Al-Mutawakkil tried to get rid of them. He even had two of the most powerful Turkic generals arrested, but the Turks, along with his son, who was angry at not being the heir apparent, plotted his assassination and eventually killed him in 861 CE. This was effectively the end of Abbasid power. From then on, all Abbasid caliphs were puppets of one Turkic general or the other. This period is known as the Anarchy at Samarra. Eventually, Al-Mutawakkil's grandson did move the capital back to Baghdad, but it didn't change much. The cancer that Al-Mu'tasim had exposed the caliphate to had completely taken over all aspects of the empire. A position of Amir al-Umara, or commander-in-chief, was established for the Turks. The Abbasids continued to lose territory. They lost all of Arabia, which broke up into various tribal entities. They lost Egypt, which was taken by the Ptolemies, their former vassals. Their clients Tahrid in Persia were overthrown by the Sepharids, who even threatened Baghdad itself. Syria broke up into independent entities early on, but was later cannibalized by the Egyptian Ptolemies. The Abbasid Empire had shrunk to a quarter of its size within 50 years. There was a brief period of recovery from 892 CE to around 904 CE, who managed to bring quite a bit of former Abbasid land back into their control. However, the empire was internally plagued by the same issues. Discontent among local dynasties was growing. During the next 40 years, the Emir al-Umara kept installing and deposing caliphs. Abbasids kept losing and gaining territory. Instability was at its worst. The caliphate even alternated twice between the same two caliphs for a while. Former Abbasid vassals that paid lip service to the Abbasids kept growing in control. Eventually, in 945 CE, a dynasty from Daylam defeated the Abbasid army under the command of Tuzun, the Emir al-Umara, and marched on Baghdad. For the first time in 300 years, the caliph was a vassal of another ruler. The Buyids replaced the Turkics as the puppet masters. They became the protectors, or sultan, of the caliphate. The caliph usually kept control over the capital city of Baghdad. This was usually done with the help of a certain group of ruffians called Ayarun. These were a class of warriors which served as local gangs, taking advantage of the increased instability due to the Shia-Sunni tensions. These Shia-Sunni tensions had been fueled by the rise of the Fatimids in Egypt and North Africa. By 970 CE, they had taken over Egypt, making Cairo their capital. A lot of people in the Abbasid realm had sympathies for the Shias. Also, the Buyids were Shia themselves. At this point, the Shias weren't exactly an entirely different sect as it is now. It was mostly just a political division. The faith systems themselves weren't very different. It would have been nothing out of the usual, except the Fatimids also called themselves caliphs. The rightful ones, since Shias believe the caliphate should have stayed in Ali's descendants, and the Fatimids claim descent from Ali and his wife Fatima, Muhammad's daughter, from whom they got their name. The Shia caliphate was doing great at a time the Sunni one was in decline, so naturally a lot of people were starting to align their sympathies with the Shia caliph. So the Abbasid caliph Al-Qadir published the Baghdad Manifesto. It was basically like a mini-medieval birther movement. the caliph got many genealogists and scholars to prove that the Fatimids were indeed not Fatima's descendants, but rather, in a shocking twist, were descendants of a Jew, which were considered an enemy of Islam itself. Meanwhile, the Fatimids were like, "I'm sorry, I can't hear you over the sound of my armies conquering Syria and Palestine." Meanwhile, in the year 1040 CE, an Oghuz Turki clan from the Eurasian steppes had just defeated the Ghaznavids in the Battle of Dandanakan. In 1055 CE, Toghril Bey captured Baghdad from the Buyids, some say on the request of the Abbasid caliph himself. Toghril Bey's brother, Chagri Bey, married his daughter, Khatun Khadija, to the caliph. This was done in the hopes that the caliphate and the sultanate would merge through their son. This didn't work out. Another sultan later tried the same with his daughter, but that didn't work out either. Things were pretty good over the next 4 years. The caliph ran the religion and the Seljuks ran the empire. It was a pretty good partnership, except the Seljuks had just started kicking the Byzantine gates. In 1071 CE, Alp Arslan defeated the Byzantines with basically no effort at the Battle of Manzikert. The Byzantines couldn't resist the Turks anymore. Turkic tribes started settling in the previously Byzantine region of Anatolia. Byzantine Emperor Alexios called on the Catholic Church to help curb the Muslim expansion, and in 1095 CE, Pope Urban in the Council of Clermont declared a crusade. Deus vult, God wills it. As you might expect, the Muslim Pope, the Caliph, suddenly had a relevance boost when he helped rally the Sunnis to the cause of defending the Holy Land. Well, more Anatolia than the Holy Land. In 1099 CE, Jerusalem fell to the Crusaders. Over the next 50 years, the relationship between the Abbasids and the Seljuks fell apart because the Sultans thought the Abbasids were interfering too much in matters of the state. The empire itself wasn't stable. Many princes and other Turkic dynasties around the empire were contending for the throne. It was the time for the Abbasids to take advantage of this. In 1125 CE, Al-Mustarshid was powerful enough to build an army and rebel. However, his rebellion didn't go far. They met the Seljuks right outside Baghdad and were defeated. Al-Mustarshid was put under house arrest. His son similarly was hostile to the Seljuks, so much so that they deposed him and he fled to Isfahan and was killed by the assassins on the way there. Finally, in 1157, Al-Muqtafi once again declared independence. This time, he was able to fight back and defend his realm, freeing it from the Seljuks. After 200 years of occupancy by foreign powers, the Abbasids were independent. Over the next 50 years, the Abbasid Caliphate managed to secure most of Iraq. However, the worst threat the Caliphate had ever faced was coming. A force unlike any the world had ever seen took over most of Eurasia. By 1227 CE, the year of Genghis Khan or Chinggis Khan's death, the Mongols were standing on the gates of Persia. They had taken over most of China, the Eurasian steppes, Khorasan, and even Persia. They had defeated the once mighty Khwarizmid Empire that had filled the vacuum left behind by the Seljuks. In 1258 CE, Hulagu Khan laid siege to Baghdad, the heartland of the Islamic Golden Age. Hulagu had demanded submission from the Caliph, which the Caliph ill-advisedly refused. Hulagu sought to make an example out of the Caliph for this insolence. According to some sources, Al-Mustasim didn't think it was an invasion and rather just another raiding party, many of which the Caliphate had pushed back. On January 29th, the siege of Baghdad began. The Caliph reportedly neglected to put a proper force together or reinforce his city's defenses. Not that it would have made any difference. According to some sources, Hulagu Khan asked for all of the city's elite, the aristocracy, the scholars, the engineers, and the bureaucracy, all of them to come outside the city for negotiation. As around 3,000 of the city's elites went for negotiations, they were all murdered. On February 10th, the city surrendered. The Mongols went on to massacre the city and its population. Some 200,000 to 800,000 or maybe even a million people were killed. The stench of the dead bodies was so bad that Hulagu didn't stay in the city for long. The survivors said that the waters of the Tigris ran black with ink from the enormous quantities of books flung into the river, and red from the blood of the scientists and philosophers killed. The city was so thoroughly destroyed that even today no signs of the core city, the circular city of peace, have been found. The caliph was killed. The Mongols feared spilling royal blood, so he was rolled up in a carpet and trampled by horses, the end of the Abbasids in Baghdad. However, one of the Abbasid princes was given refuge by the Egyptian Mamluks. He and his descendants held the title of the Caliph, only in name, for the next 300 years. In 1517 CE, the Ottoman Sultan Selim Yavuz invaded Egypt and took the title of the Caliph for himself. Almost a millennia after Muhammad's death, the title of the Caliph went to someone outside Muhammad's tribe, the Quraysh. See you next time.